This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, Ken offers Christian reflections on the world's religions. In particular, we're taking a look at some of the numbers in response to a Pew Research Center article that Ken has given us. Ken, I always thank you for passing along these materials. Staggering numbers here. Now, let's see what they mean. So,
yes, thank you, Joe. Yeah. I think that one way of looking at the world is to look at it through the prism of a worldview. And obviously here at Reasons to Believe, we are a science faith think tank. We're an apologetics organization, and largely we take up the issues of science and its relationship to Christianity. So things like evolution and the multiverse and lots of different challenges are very relevant. And we've spent a lot of time, particularly with our founder and president, Hugh Ross, looking at how Christianity and science are compatible. I think what's interesting, gentlemen, is that I think there's another issue that looms. If I were to answer the question, what are the two greatest challenges to the Christian worldview, I would say science and the world's religions. If you look at the world, I mean, we spend a lot of time responding to Richard Dawkins or responding to Stephen Hawking or responding to Lawrence Krauss or any number of atheists who is a scientist. But the reality is that the number of atheists in the world is pretty small. Now, it's not insignificant. I mean, most atheists live in North America or in Europe. And if you look at the academy, the university, there is a predominance of atheist naturalists.
They have significant platforms.
But if you start looking at numbers, like from the Pew Research Center, you begin to realize that, non-atheist agnostics or skeptics may make up 10, maybe 15%. But that means there's 85 to 90% of people who have adopted some kind of religious worldview. And I don't think anybody can get away from the fact that we live in a world where we have this challenge of radical Islam and terrorism. It seems like it's on the television all the time.
You use that term.
And I've used the term radical Islam, which makes me politically incorrect and unacceptable, but I think it's true. I think that there is a radical Islam, and I think that the world's religions remain a very critical element. And by the way, the world's religions also use science to justify their worldview. I used to teach a class at Biola entitled World Religions and Science, where I would look specifically at how Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, Christians, Muslims appeal to science to justify their worldview perspective. So I think these numbers are very relevant. Of course, one of the reasons why I wrote the book God Among Sages, I think that some important elements that came out of my book, one, I think it's very important that people, particularly Christians, know who Jesus is. I also think that there may be a real reason to return to a Christological apologetic. That is, rather than kind of reasoning through the traditional arguments for God's existence, maybe we ought to lead with Jesus. And the reason I say that is everybody has an opinion about him already. And most people have a fairly friendly opinion about him already. I mean, Muslims, if you were to say to a Muslim, maybe in the Middle East or in South Asia, that I'm a follower of Jesus, that would be received a lot better than if you were to say, I'm a historic Christian. And Hindus have views of Jesus, and Buddhists have views. The Dalai Lama says that that Jesus was likely an enlightened Buddha. So everybody has a view of Jesus, so I think that that's a relevant component of my book. And I also think, guys, that it's important to then ask the question, how in a global society, how in a pluralistic, politically correct world, how do we distinguish our belief in Jesus? So I want to talk in this program, Joe, a little bit about some of the statistics that have come out of the Pew Research Center about religions and their projections, and then to offer some of my own thoughts about evangelism and apologetics and worldview.
All right. Sounds like a good plan.
Well, let me, I'm going to read here. There was an article the Pew Research Center puts out regularly articles. This one is called The Future of World Religions, Population Growth Projections, 2010 to 2050. And the subtitle is Why Muslims Are Rising Fastest and the Unaffiliated Are Shrinking as a Share of the World's Population. Very provocative there. Essentially, it says this. It says the religious profile of the world is rapidly changing. I'm quoting now from the Pew Research. Driven primarily by differences in fertility rates and the size of youth populations among the world's major religions, as well as by people switching faiths, over the next four decades, Christians will remain the largest religious group, but Islam will grow faster than any other major religion. If current trends continue by 2050, now they make some conclusions. First, the number of Muslims will nearly equal the number of Christians around the world. They say, by the way, in another article, that by 2050, there'll be 9 billion people on the planet, about 3 billion Christian and about 3 billion Muslim, and then the rest of religious and non-religious will be another 3 billion. Mm. Now, the article continues. It says, atheists, agnostics, and other people who do not affiliate with any religion, though increasing in countries such as the United States and France, will make up a declining share of the world's total population. So we, one of the issues that motivated me to write God Among Sages, I mean, somebody probably asked the question, maybe even Hugh Ross asked the question, why does Ken Samples write a book on world religions when we're a science faith organization? Mm. Well, one of the reasons is because everybody has to try to make sense of the world. And from a worldview standpoint, that's a major question. Religion and science, I think, are the two major elements. It also helps that that's my background and that's what I'm skilled at. The Pew Report continues, the global Buddhist population will be about the same size as it was in 2010, while the Hindu and Jewish populations will be larger than they are today. Interesting. In Europe, Muslims will make up 10% of the overall population. India will retain a Hindu majority, but also have the largest Muslim population of any country in the world, surpassing Indonesia. Wow. So India is not just a Hindu country, it's a Muslim country. By the way, could I say, the Buddha was born in India, and today there are almost no Buddhists in India. Hmm. They're all in Southeast Asia, largely. Mm-hmm. Goes on to say,
Japan, is there a lot of Buddhists in Japan?
Japan, Thailand, yeah, okay. Philippines,
China,
Korea, China, right? The Pew Report continues, in the United States, Christians will decline from more than three-quarters of the population in 2010 to two-thirds in 2050. Judaism will no longer be the largest non-Christian religion. Muslims will be more numerous in the U.S. than people who identify as Jewish on the basis of religion. 4 out of every 10 Christians in the world will live in sub-Saharan Africa.
Wow.
Interesting ideas about the world in which we live and the different religious faces that we discover. Now, you know, statistics are important. For example, if you go back 100 years, let's go back to 1900. In 1900, there were about 500 million Christians in the world. About 33% of the population were Christian. Islam was significantly less. It was about 12% of the population. Move forward 100 years, Christianity is still 33% of the population. Now, it's more Christians because there's more people, but the market share for Christians has not changed. Islam, on the other hand, in 100 years has almost doubled. So now the question is, why? Well, the Pew report indicates that birth rate, very important. While European birth rate is way down, the Islamic birth rate is way up. That's an element in all of this.
So it's birth rate, not conversion, that's the reason?
It's a very important part of it. It may not be the whole thing, but it's a very important part of it. I think also that, you know, there are people who don't live in the Western world. They often have a very different orientation of looking at reality. You know, the question of would you move away from your faith? Let's say you're born in Indonesia. Let's say you're born in the Middle East, and you come from a Islamic family. The decision to leave Islam, to either become a skeptic or to become some other religion, Christian, that might be viewed very differently than if you were born in the United States or in Europe. I mean, it's almost expected in Europe and the United States that if you're religious, you're going to go through your teenage years. You may challenge various issues. You know, but if you are Asian, you may think moving away from my religion is a very big issue. And, you know, it's the numbers that bother me about radical Islam are not that Islam is so large. It is large. It's 1.678 billion. It's on its way to 3 billion in 2050. The question is, how many Muslims are radical Muslims? I think it's probably a small number. I will tell you the stat that does trouble me, though. It's the stat, even in fairly moderate Muslim nations, that say that many Muslims agree that if you were to leave your faith, it would justify execution. That troubles me, that even in fairly moderate countries, they think leaving Islam, becoming an apostate, may be a lethal offense.
Wow.
So, you know, as we look at these numbers, we ask the question, why is Islam growing? Well, I think birth rate is very significant. I also think another issue, I think Islam is closer to the man on the street view of religion than is Christianity. Now, you know, I may have to concede a little bit here because I think a lot of people in Christendom basically have a man on the street view. But what I mean by the man on the street view is I think a lot of people think that heaven is reserved for Mother Teresa and Martin Luther King, Gandhi, these holy people, these significantly moral people or people who've stood up for the poor. And hell is reserved for Hitler and Stalin and, you know, the terrible murderers, Charles Manson. And then the rest of us are in the middle. And maybe if we do good works, God will, you know, give us a he'll grade on a curve, right? remember that in your educational system where I'm going to grade on a curve. I'm not going to I'm not going to have a strict, you know, you got to get 93% to get an A. I'm going to judge, well, Joe had a high grade, Dave had a little lower grade, but I'll judge on that curb. I think lots of people think that heaven is, you know, it's for the saintly people. Hell is for the really evil people. And most of us are in the middle. So we'll go to purgatory. Or God will cut us some slack. And Islam largely says that. Paradise is something you earn by your obedience. Hell is something you earn by your disobedience. Islam is fundamentally not a religion of grace. It is not a religion of redemption. I mean, you don't need a savior. You need a prophet to call you back to obedience and so that you can maybe do well in the judgment. I think a lot of people, Joe, feel that way. And I think that makes sense to a lot of people. By the way, growing up Catholic, I think a lot of Catholics have that understanding. I think lots of people have that understanding that, and I think that draws people into a religious sense. Do you pray five times a day? You know, do you go to Mecca? Do you give to the poor? And so I think another part is not just the number of babies that are born, but I think there is also that kind of theological element that pulls into it. To say that all of us are worthy of hell, I have an author that I really enjoy, and I wrote a review of his book. If you go on to Reflections these days, you will see me writing a series, Take Up and Read, where I review Christian classics and sometimes even just literary classics. So I reviewed Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. And in that book, Frankl, like a modern Jew, says there are two types of people in the world, the decent and the indecent. And I thought immediately, this doesn't correspond to my theological assessment that there are only one kind of people in the world, indecent. But Frankl represents modern Judaism. And Frankl, I thought, made a very powerful point. It stunned me when I thought about it. He said, you know what? There are two types of people, decent and the indecent. And he says, sometimes the guards in the camp were decent, and sometimes the inmates were the indecent. And I thought, whoa. So his categories were making me think and provoking me. And I think maybe the biggest issue in life is pain and suffering and the problem of evil. And so Frankl, as a Jew, has a lot to say that Christians can both agree and disagree with. But it's back to this idea that maybe part of the growth of Islam is that it's the religion of the natural man. Mm-hmm. And I have many Catholic friends who thought, you know, look, Ken, I'm not Mother Teresa, but I'm not Charles Manson, so I'm in the middle. I think part of the attraction of Islam is that basically it's a religion of works. And it is basically a religion where you earn it, right? You do it the old-fashioned way. You earn it. And so I think that's part of the element. Now, to go a little further in kind of our discussion here, I think it's important to also appreciate that world in 2050 is going to be a very diverse world. And, you know, we have skeptics, we have atheists, we have agnostics, and they often think that religious people are not careful in their thinking. They adopt things by faith. They haven't critically analyzed facts and reasons and evidence informing their basic beliefs. But I think it's important to say that human beings have been and likely will always be very religious people. Mm. Now, the Christian explanation for this is that a very important part of being made in the image of God is that we're worshipers. And that when the fall happened and we began to suppress the truth of God, that worshiping element doesn't go away. When we reject the biblical God and we want to dodge our moral accountability with him, which makes questions like hell and these kinds of things such controversial, how could there be a God who would actually cast people into hell? But when we want to dodge our moral obligation with God, that does not mean that our need to worship disappears. It means likely that it goes somewhere else. And I see it all the time. Atheists, you know, they have churches. Now, there's a church in London, and they were asked, well, why do you have an atheist church? Well, we need community. We need a belief, you know. And then I found it interesting that there was a division within the atheist church. they were broken. Mm. They couldn't agree on the creed. And what do people worship? Well, in the West, they worship their vacation. Yeah. They worship pleasure. You know, they worship any number of things. And so people are very religious. And I think, Joe and Dave, that this goes a long way to suggest that the Bible gets certain things right about human beings.
Turns out.
Yeah, we have a religious impulse. Because one of the bullet points you mentioned was that atheists and agnostics will be on the decline,
yeah.
Whereas the other religions, almost all of them, will be on the rise. Now, the atheists have often said that as knowledge increases in this world, people will eventually come around and understand that this is all nonsense. We just need more education in this world.
Right.
And people will realize that this is all myth. So one of the world's problems is we just lack knowledge.
That's right.
We just need more education. Well, we're getting that more and more. But it looks like world religions are going to be on the rise. Now, are you saying that to the atheists? Are you saying that Muslims and Christians and Jews, for that matter, are going to remain ignorant? No. You can't say that because everybody has internet access, for crying out loud. We're all gaining in knowledge. So what is the reason then?
I think, Joe, you've put your finger on it. And I think that all of our worldviews, whether it's some form of theism or whether it's some form of mystical pantheism or whether it's some form of secularism, we're all making predictions. We're all saying, here's how our worldview will predict how things will be. If from an atheistic naturalist perspective, the more knowledge that people have, the greater access they have to it, the more skeptical they will become. Well, to some degree, I think we have seen that. But according to the Pew Report, it's reaching its end. And I think if we look a little deeper, I mean, you know, when I read atheist literature, and I try to read the more thoughtful, the more reflective atheists, because some, you know, there are times on Twitter I had a guy, you know, give me 14 arguments, and I wanted to come back and say, these are silly. These aren't even worth me responding to. I hope you've decided to give up on God for something more substantive than this. But there are other atheists that I think ask really good questions, and I think they're worthy of our best responses. But when I look at some of the thoughtful atheists, they say, they communicate that they need to explain certain things as an atheist, like, how do we ground and justify reason and rationality? We believe that reason and rationality lead you to atheism, but in a world that is the product of blind mechanistic natural processes, how do you justify reason and rationality? Couldn't it all be simply a the fact that it's determined, right? It's naturalistically determined. Now, I think when we look at the atheists, they're trying to explain reason. They're trying to explain some basic objective morality, and they're trying to give meaning to life. That's a worldview. Quite frankly, you know, maybe you don't want to use the word religion, but it's really kind of a religious worldview. They're trying to say we can have reason, we can have morality, we can have purpose, and that's basically what generally defined religions do. There's a reason to be there, and there's a reason to guide your life. So I still think the Bible has done a pretty good job of predicting, you know, where people are going. People tend to be very religious in orientation. And I think that we can also then begin to talk a little bit, Joe, about how the religions take a diversity of positions. Let me tell you something that I reveal in my book, God Among Sages, that I didn't know 10 years ago. And I'm embarrassed to say that, partly because I've been teaching world religions for 25 years, but I only discovered about 10 years ago that most Hindus are not pantheists. Most Hindus are bhakti Hindus that worship one God. And I thought, well, how did I miss that? Well, you know, Hinduism is a set of religions. Gerald McDermott, an evangelical Protestant author of the world's religions, says, think of Hinduism as a set of religions. There's the pantheistic side. There's the polytheistic side. And by the way, in Hinduism, you could believe in 330 million gods. I mean, that's a lot of gods.
But one simplifies it.
One simplifies it. And so then I have a face-to-face discussion with a Hindu, and he's talking about why he believes in Krishna, and I'm talking about why I believe in Jesus. Well, that changes the whole orientation at that point. I can then say, well, who do you think would be the better guide, Krishna or Jesus? Who's more credible? Who has the better resume? Who's more connected to history? How do you know Krishna's not a myth? How do you know Jesus isn't a myth? When you begin to see, there is a movement toward monotheism. Even within Hinduism, to say nothing of Islam and Judaism and Zoroastrianism. So the question of monotheism remains a very significant issue. And I would reason differently, Joe, with a Zoroastrian and a Muslim and a Jew than I would with a Buddhist. Because in Buddhism, it's typically atheistic. There's no sin, as the atheist that I debated. It was really more of a dialogue. I'm really glad I did it, too. I think that you actually had a real dialogue between two people who hold different religions, but it was not a slugfest. It was not who can insult each other. It was a real discussion. Who has the better resume, Buddha or Jesus? Which religion seems to explain humanity better? But, you know, in Buddhism, there's no God. There can't be any sin because there's no God to sin against. But here's another wrinkle in all of this, Joe and Dave. And the wrinkle is, I think Buddhism is a very serious challenge to Christianity. You know why I think that? Because I think Buddhism gets a lot right. It would be great if all the non-Christian religions got everything wrong. Then we could just say, well, it's all wrong. But I think the Buddha was a very intuitive philosopher, and when he talks about pain and suffering, and he says that this material transitory world is never going to satisfy you, most Christians say he's right. So what makes the world's religions tricky is they have both truth and falsity, and then you throw into the mix the devil and his deceptive power, you realize that maybe the most powerful evidence of the devil or the demonic in this world is religion. Mm-hmm. So you have a real dynamic here where are these religions going? It seems the Pew Report indicates that, if anything, people are going to be more religious by 2050, that Islam will challenge Christianity, and that all of these religions will be putting different elements. So how do we reason about them? One of the things I try to do in God Among Sages is to say, you know, I think the best thing Christianity has going for it is Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, why not use him?
And as you just mentioned there in that example, we most of us listening to this podcast live in a suburban area, probably, if not an urban area, where we are likely to encounter somebody of a different faith, probably even a Buddhist, and we're walking our dog in the park or what have you. This might be a connection point with that person, this type of example, where they might want to talk about, you know, this very element, where their Buddhist faith gets them through the day, and this might be a place where you can talk about, you know, how they discuss the problem of evil and how Jesus really is superior when it comes to...
I appreciate you raising that very point,
overcoming
Joe,
that.
Because I had a fellow who listened to my recent dialogue debate with a Hindu and then my dialogue and debate with a Buddhist on Justin Brierley's program. All this can be accessed.
It's the Unbelievable podcast.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Go right on there and you can click on it. But what I wanted to say is this one fellow on Facebook said to me, I thought your dialogue was very interesting, that often it came down to Buddha is a doctor and Jesus is a doctor, and both of them have made diagnoses. And now we ask, well, which diagnosis is correct? And then which treatment and cure? And how many miraculous cures have you had? That is, it did in effect come down to, well, who seems to be most effectual, and can Buddhism change your life? And if so, how do you measure it? Does Christianity change your life? The point I'm making is, rather than debating the technical areas of nirvana or of, you know, whether they're monotheistic or atheistic, often it came down to the question of, how does my religious philosophy help me navigate in the world in which I live?
Can I live it? I wanted to ask the question of, in all of these religions, there's a strong secularism that's going on. In Christianity, you know, there's these big numbers, huge, you know, a third of 3 billion people in a certain period of time. But when you examine that closely, there's only a small fraction of them who are really practicing their religious faith. They may identify themselves as Christian, but they're really secular in the way that they live. And my understanding of Islam is the same thing. You can be identifying as Islam, but many of them are very secular in their practice. And I'm sure that's true in Judaism and the other religions. So how does that play into this whole issue?
No, that's a good question. I'm glad you ask it. Because the reality is, I remember my wife working at a local hospital, and part of her collecting information, you know, in terms of getting good information so that the hospital could get the medical records for a person, or maybe making sure you have the right insurance. But part of all that collection of information would also involve a survey of, well, how would you identify? Would you like, I remember Joan would tell me, the way I ask it is, would you like to identify a particular faith tradition? And, you know, one of the answers would be none. I don't identify with any one of them. Or, you know, is it Christian or is it Muslim? Which then raises the question, Dave, that there are some religions where it can seem more cultural. You know, I come from the Middle East, or I come from South Asia. I come from a Islamic tradition, or I come from maybe a Confucian, Taoist, Buddhist tradition. Or
so I identify that as my tradition.
That's right. And you're asking the question, but how does it shake out in terms of people really being devoted? How much do they really believe it? How much do they really devote themselves to? And I think it is important to appreciate that there are Muslims that are liberal, meaning that, well, you know, I don't take it quite as seriously as some, or, you know, I am a little more open to a diversity of thought than some.
They'll marry.
I might marry somebody. That's right. Now, Judaism is probably the best example. I think it's fair to say, I think statistics indicate that probably most of the Jewish people in the world are not religious. So while they identify with a religious tradition, they may be more influenced by science.
Right.
They may be influenced more by their culture. Catholicism, good example, where you may have a Italian background, you may have a Mexican background, you may have a Polish background, but, you know, you may pick and choose. You may be a cafeteria Catholic in that kind of context. I would say a couple things to it, Dave. I would say, number one, that it is true that there is this flex. It is kind of a spectrum. Right. You have the more liberal or less religious, and then, oh, I'm a fundamentalist. You know, I'm a flaming fundamentalist. I, though, also think that when people get older, they do continue to ask questions about religion. So even if you're on the scale, most people are still religious. How committed they are to the specifics of Hinduism or the specifics of Buddhism is a question. But in a broader context, people tend to be very religious. I mean, lots of people in the Asian world would say that they accept kind of a consensus, and that is, when it comes to life and death issues, they're a Buddhist, reincarnation. When it comes to their spirituality, they're a Taoist, mystical. And then when it comes to their ethics, they're Confucian. That's an interesting kind of element, and you might not necessarily see any particular religious devotion, but they have a very religious worldview in that kind of context. So even if you, I mean, I agree with you, not all Muslims are very devout, not all Hindus are very devout, not all Christians are very devout, but I think it's very difficult to completely separate. I mean, I'll give you an example. I knew a guy on Twitter. And so one time I just asked him, I said, you know, you've tweeted 10,000 times, and they're all about a God you say you don't believe in. Couldn't you find something more useful to do with your time? To which I said to him, could it be that in your psychology, you haven't yet moved away from God, and that maybe you're battling him, and you're saying he doesn't exist, but you don't seem to be convincing yourself.
My friend, who's an atheist, he says that he's been, as a child, abused.
Conditioned.
And he's been conditioned, so he can't get away from it because he's been corrupted by his...
Well, you know, that's interesting, Dave. And I would say this, whatever way we explain it, whether it's an evolutionary explanation or whether it's a biblical explanation, human beings seem to be obsessed with issues of ultimate meaning and purpose. Now, remember, though, that can take different shapes. I mean, I think most people's idolatry is in the accumulation of things. Or it's in getting as much pleasure as you possibly can. So most people are not thinking in terms of atheism, pantheism, theism. They're thinking in terms of the accumulation of wealth, as much pleasure as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. A practical religiosity that is tied into all of these mm-hmm. kinds of things.
When I ask the question, you know, I'm thinking in largely my experience with Christianity, and I just see that even within the church that I attend, it seems like people are more influenced by what they see on TV, by the sitcoms.
The Hollywood worldview.
The Hollywood worldview, and that there's this secularism that just kind of smothers the more religious aspects of their life. It could be thought of and still as religion, but it becomes, like you said, a Hollywood kind of religion.
Well, let me push the circle a little further. I noticed the other day I went out to lunch with some of the scholars, particularly Fuzz and Jeff and myself, and we could not talk about sports. Now, there were a couple people there that we knew were not sports people, and they weren't terribly interested, and I'm sure they felt rather awkward, but we didn't care.
It's the NBA playoffs. Come on.
You know, people are consumed with certain things. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, I mean, the Super Bowl has become a national holiday.
Sundays were made for...
Yeah, I mean, why did God put church and football on the same day? You know, that's that's a contradiction. Right. But you have other elements. How important is entertainment? How big has TV been in influencing mm-hmm. people? I mean, you know, we talk about video games, we talk about smartphones, we talk about social media. I'm telling you, in 1966, when my dad brought home a color TV, it was like it was a worldview orientation.
World-changing.
Yeah, it was like, whoa, this, you know, I remember my favorite show was Combat, and it would say, Combat in color. Ooh! I think, guys, even if you change the orientation to not talking about philosophical worldviews or tradition or religious traditions, you know, how much do people care about how much money they make? How much do people care about how much pleasure they have? How much do people care about having all the nice things that you find to be acceptable? I think those are the things that drive our lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Bible is right. We are made to be worshipers. If we don't worship the true and living God, we'll worship something. Mm-hmm. I remember as a teenager, and I don't know that I processed all of it. I think I definitely sensed that I was seeking. I was searching for something. I had this sense that something missing in my life. Now, I don't know to what degree that engaged a sense of reflection and saying, well, why do I do this and what are the options? But I know I was seeking and I was looking and I thought, well, maybe being a professional athlete, you know, I'll have money, I'll have fame, maybe meeting the right woman, maybe that will solve the whole problem. It seems to me that human beings are searching. And a lot of times, we think what we want is a good time from the past or, you know, some physical object or some pleasurable experience.
Or a distraction.
Or a distraction.
I think that guilt is a common denominator in people.
And
they want to be distracted from it.
And I think what people are looking for is God. I think the biblical view is that the unbeliever both desires and resists God simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Can I have at least a final question, unless Dave has anything more, on one of the points here, in case there's another in-depth article that you're aware of. In the United States, Christians will decline from more than 3/4 of the population in 2010 to 2/3 in 2050. Now, do you know why that is? Is it because they're declining in belief or population. Muslims are on the rise, it says in that same point, bullet point. But did they give any other reason in any follow-up article?
Well, let me give you, first of all, a statistical point of view. I noticed that in 2012, Christians made up 33%. Now, here's a Pew article I have from April of 2017. It's down to 31%. Mm-hmm. I, again, would raise the issue that it may be multiple factors. Now, again, going back to my wife collecting data at the hospital, typically the way we've thought of Europe is, you know, how many Europeans, how many Christians? Mm-hmm. The numbers, they're not even having a replacement. They can't even replace the number of people. They're having so few children, which makes me think they're probably more secular, or mm-hmm. or they're thinking, I could have a nicer car if I didn't have to have all these kids, or I don't have to be quite as responsible if I don't have all these kids. Maybe I'm happier if I don't have children. Where the traditional view was a significant part of life is marrying, and if you marry, having kids and things of that nature. I think there may be other factors, both the growth of secularism and the growth of alternative religions may impact that. But think about it. Here we are, right? We're 2017. 2050 is only a couple decades ahead. 3 billion people on the planet. That's a lot of people. You have to feed a lot of people. 3 billion Christian. Islam, just as big, maybe bigger. Mm-hmm. 2060, there's an article in here about 2060 that says Islam may outgrow Christianity. And then a whole other 3 billion. Most of them, the vast majority of them, religious. I mean, these questions aren't going to go away. Evangelism, mission, apologetics, these issues are very, very important to us and very critical. And I think Christians need to think about these kinds of things. I mean, what would happen if you walked into your church tomorrow, Dave, or Sunday morning, or your church, Joe, Sunday morning, and I got up and I said, by the way, one of the best research organization indicates that by 2050, there will be an equal number of Muslims that there are Christians. And by 10 years after that, there may be more Muslims than Christians. That might change the way people in the view think about a lot of these issues. It might change the way we think about how do we prepare people? How do we help people? How do we communicate? Maybe we ought to do more reading and more thinking and more reflecting about, in a diverse global society, now with the internet, now with the influx of different cultures, how do we talk about Christianity? I mentioned in a previous show that I would talk about Christianity differently in a different context, and I've mentioned here that my discussion with a Jew and a Muslim would be very different than my discussion with a Buddhist. Well, we now live in a cultural melting pot. How do we think about these kinds of issues? I'm holding up my book, God Among Sages. Jesus is a very powerful vehicle. And I'm thinking in terms of apologetic methodology. Should I lead with the moral argument? Should I lead with the cosmological argument? Or should I lead with the Christological argument? Should I say, you have some sense of Jesus? Let's talk about him. Let's see how, you know, he does. And I have to say, I think one of the, if not the most powerful things that influenced me to no longer be a nominal Catholic, but to become a deeply engaged Christian, was the Jesus I encountered in the New Testament. I couldn't get away from him. I didn't want to get away from him. I wanted to learn as much about him as possible. And I wondered why these people who came and knocked on the door had a different view of him. And so, you know, I think that this question of the world's religions and religiosity as a whole, I think the Bible gets some things right. And I think one of the things that it does a very good job of explaining the fundamental nature of what it means to be human, that we seem to strive, we seem to hunger for meaning and purpose and significance, and yet there is a moral breakdown in humanity. And I guess we could throw into that, there's also a human exceptionalism. We are very different than the animals, but it is a brokenness and a religiosity. And at that point, I think we have a good bit of Genesis 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Great stuff. And I will strongly recommend your book, God Among Sages, for those who want to engage people in other world religions.
Buy two of them.
Buy two of them.
Buy two of them.
As we have said in previous podcasts. All right. That's going to wrap it up. Be sure and get God Among Sages by Ken Samples. You will not regret it. You have connecting points and places where you can find common ground among those who are practicing other religions. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.